And we begin with the proposed improvements to Everbank Field. Did you hear about this? A $63 million upgrade looks to be heading to the end zone after city council members heard a pitch on Tuesday from Jaguars owner Shad Khan. Now, Khan wants to pay $20 million himself for these upgrades. The city would assume the remaining $43 million. Here's Jaguars president Mark Lamping.
We're trying to make sure that our fans have the ability to stay connected, to be able to follow what's happening around the National Football League at all times, to be able to get information that is easy to obtain if you choose to stay home and watch the games on TV. It is so easy to stay at home on Sundays and watch National Football League.
Now, the changes at the stadium would include these splashy new video boards and a water feature. It's been described as a swimming pool or pools for the stadium. It was a 13-1 vote to advance this legislation. Councilman Stephen Jost, the only holdout, he's not convinced that this is a good investment of taxpayer money. And we want our callers, we want you to tell us what you think about that right now. What are your thoughts about the city council signing off in this deal for Everbank Field to the tune of $43 million? That's the city's investment. The number to call the show, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. We are already getting your comments as well on our Facebook page. Tim Gibbons of the Business Journal, let's begin with you. Mark Lamping and Shad Khan are both trying to make the business case for these improvements.
They are indeed. I mean, the NFL is a very different thing than it was, you know, say when the Jaguars first got here. And the experience has to, in their view, change with the times, basically, and be something that just has more pizzazz in the stadium itself. Of course, the city's picking up most of the tab for that pizzazz, which is where it becomes an issue.
Right. Andrew Pantazzi, the TU, reporting that Mr. Khan said, telling the council, I'll pay $20 million of this. You guys have to pick up the rest.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because that is, he is willing to drop down $20 million, but it's still an issue of can the city council afford to put down the $43 million with additional tax revenue to pay for the rest, and whether that's a good investment. I know Mr. Lamping is saying that having a better team is not the only way to increase the fan base, and he believes having a better stadium can draw more people to the stands. And I don't know if that's going to work or not, if Jaguars fans are going to go to the stadium just because they have a bigger video screen or a better stadium.
Yeah, Fred Matthews, what are your thoughts about those who have said, why is the city spending this money in an era when we're looking at they've had a hard time even keeping library doors open and fire stations open?
Well, even though the pot of money that this is coming from is totally separate, it is simply the act of what we're looking at. We're talking about jobs in the city. We're talking about a cut to the Meals on Wheels program that benefits seniors and people who actually need it. Folks are also looking at a cut in food stamps. It's coming up. That's a federal thing, but it is still hitting here home. And to look at this playground, which is what it is, folks, the two things just don't mesh. And even though it was softened, the blow is softened a bit as they begin to tell people that it's actually not going to be a swimming pool that's going to be up there.
Yeah, they're saying it's a water feature.
It's going to be a water feature now. That still doesn't make people feel any better. And overlying all of this is the fact that, we have a conservative Republican city council approving funding of this nature at a time in which they had to go out and find X million dollars to fill a budget hole in the city council, in the city's budget.
I find it interesting, and you started out by, you know, saying, as is accurate, that it's two different pots of money. But the optics of it are such a it doesn't matter if it's two pots of money when you say big scoreboards, closed libraries. It's a hard thing.
Kyle Sieg, on our Facebook page, Eddie writes the show, Khan is just trying to drum up a case to move the team to Europe. If the council refuses anything, he can list as substantial. Still some cynicism out there that this team isn't in it, isn't going to stay here.
I think there's overwhelming cynicism and skepticism about all of this. I mean, a lot of the people we hear from, I don't know if they're not speaking to the city council or if the city council isn't listening, but a lot of the reaction we're getting is that this is just a distraction for a really bad team. And that's the bottom line. And then when you rebut that with, well, they say, you know, it could bring in bigger acts to the stadium, it could bring in more money in other ways, people just aren't buying it. You're right. I think it's a PR problem. It's an optics issue.
And we want to know your thoughts right now. It's our top story of the week on the Media Roundtable. What's your opinion on the city council appearing to move forward? They're close to signing off on this deal to improve Everbank Field with new video boards, a water feature, and more. The city would kick in $43 million for these improvements. Let us know your thoughts. 549-2937 to join the show. Bill in South Point. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Hey, I agree with everything your folks have said there. I think they should just let the Jaguars go. I haven't seen a real hard economic audit about how, quote, profitable this has been for the city. I would grant you that the owners are making money. We take part in the cuts of the TV revenues. I think that would help a lot. That's just my thought.
All right. And thanks for the call, Bill. Lots of tweets coming in as well. Here's one from Damon. $20 million, please. We need to end corporate welfare for billionaires and their private enterprises. From Daniel. Seriously, I wasn't a pool fan, but what is the deal with these water features? What's the point of it all?
Apparently. Yeah, that was one of my questions. In my mind, they went from pools to apparently they were described as like hot tubs at one point. And I was really hoping they'd have those simply for like the monster truck jam, because I wanted people sitting in hot tubs. I had this mental idea.
And if they're proven right, and all of these features do drive attendance, drive revenue, drive buzz, they will be seen as
water features are also supposed to be kind of a showcasing Florida sort of thing.
Right, showcase we're on the water.
Exactly, that brings in tourists, and apparently.
But the problem with that scenario, and I think most folks would like to like that. The problem with that is that Green Bay doesn't have it. Kansas City doesn't have it. They're in one of the smaller media markets. Chicago doesn't have it. It's doubtful Detroit's ever going to get it. And New York doesn't have it. And New England doesn't have it. But they're thriving. Their teams are doing well. Yeah. That's the counter economic argument we have here. But again, this is going to happen. 13-1 vote in this committee of the whole. You've got Paul Hardin, one of the leading lobbyist attorney on the side of the Jaguars, going for this thing. And you got city council leadership from the president, past presidents of the council, all for it. It's going to happen. It's just a question of what happens next. One final thing that I see on this, that Mr. Khan still didn't help himself very much when, again, the question was posed to him. What's going to happen if you are you going to move the team? And basically his answer comes back now. I have deeds will do better than actions. Actions will do better than deeds. Yes or no?
Well, they're saying he was putting his money where his mouth is when he was negotiating for business over in London. Meanwhile, Jim tweets the show, build the world's largest scoreboard at Everbank Field, $63 million. The ability for the Jaguars to put touchdowns on it, priceless. Let's go to the phones again. Jonathan in Atlantic Beach is with us. Hi, Jonathan. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I really like that tweet. just a quick comment. There is an intrinsic value to having the Jaguars here in Jacksonville. There is a looming threat, you know, of them moving, due to the lack of attendance, et cetera. If the city council does do this, which I'm not a big fan of them doing, but if they do it, I think they should tie in Khan contractually to keep the Jaguars here for a specific amount of time, say 20 years or something like that. That way, you know, we get a return on the investment that we would make.
Thanks for that, Jonathan. Contractually, is that even possible, though?
Well, their lease now is breakable. Any lease is breakable.
Yeah, but they can always break it.
But the issue is that if they break it, they basically have to open their books. And everybody I've talked to says the NFL would never let them do that. I don't know if that could be extended for future years, but it's an interesting quid pro quo that...
Andrew.
And they could always just add more games overseas every year. I haven't seen the contract, so I don't know exactly what would break it. But I think it's fascinating to look at economic analyses when they look at what a stadium does to a city, and the effect is really nil. When they look at places like Baltimore, or they look at places that have struggling communities surrounding stadiums and the effort to improve the stadiums, which doesn't help the communities around it. The idea is people are supposed to go to the stadium, then walk around and spend money in the area. I don't know very many people who go to Jaguars games and walk around in the east side of downtown and say, I'm going to go spend money in the area and help the community.
And we are hearing that Mr. Khan is eyeing the Shipyards property for that very deficit. But, of course, that's not the reality today. But let's go to Mary up in, or down in St. John's. Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. My thought is, from what I understand, people aren't moving to Jacksonville to go to the stadium or watch the Jaguars, but they are leaving and coming to St. John's County for the schools and the safe police. So it's just, that would have, that's my thought.
No, I mean, I think that makes sense. She's
thanks, Mary.
Because the whole issue is, will this attract business? And then the intrinsic value that was mentioned earlier. I mean, it puts Jacksonville's name, yes, on a global scale. People can know Jacksonville Jaguars. But is it actually convincing anyone to either visit or to move to Jacksonville?
That will tell the tale. Let's go to Edwin in San Marco this morning. Good morning, Edwin. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
I just was wanting to share my thoughts on the situation regarding the football team and the stadium. I mean, like you say, we're all about being fiscal with money and everybody's cutting budgets. And why would our city spend our tax-earned dollars in order to beautify or to update a stadium where a team, they're not winning, and we still have to buy tickets to go to the game? So if I'm not compelled to go to the stadium to see the team, then why would we spend money on a scoreboard like I heard earlier on your show? They're not going to put points on the board. So what's a billion-dollar scoreboard going to do to improve the action on the football field? I don't think it's going to do anything.
Thank you for that, Edwin. And Mark Lamping quoted in the TU saying, we understand, of course, we have to have a winning team, but there are other things we're looking at, too, these cosmetic changes.
But this is the overwhelming response. I mean, the same response we're getting from your callers is the same response I think a lot of us have heard, and it's overwhelmingly negative. So regardless of if this is happening, there's still going to be this negative idea, this negative image to combat because of this.
Let's go ahead.
All right, it's interesting how it really does come down to that. You know, win a stinking game, and then we can talk about it. It's like right. You know, we'll give you the scoreboards, but you know, win first.
Let's go to Bobby on the north side. Hi, Bobby.
Yes, I would like to start off to say that I believe the Jaguars are a great asset to this city, but to lock up our bed tax money for 20 years for an improvement that, you know, is not going to last 20 years is short-sighted. We're also going to incur annual costs to compensate for the seats that we're going to have to build to meet our obligation to the Florida-Georgia game. And number three, if we lose our access to our waterfront parks, say $58,000, and then give $43 million to the Jaguars, that's just a terrible priority.
All right. Thanks, Bobby. Fred Matthews.
Well, the Florida State Legislature didn't approve this deal, which is why it's sitting in the City Council. They didn't approve it, along with what Miami wanted, and I imagine Tampa wanted some of that for their teams. And there's a reason why they didn't approve it, because the financial benefit was not there in the legislation. And it's doubtful that that legislation is going to come back to Tallahassee this spring. So this is clearly on the cities to do what they want to do with their own team, and it's facing Jacksonville. I mean, that's what we are. The political realities apparently are not are that the sitting city council members have to look at where their support is going to come from. And again, when you look at who's lobbying for the bill, when you look at the fact that we've got another billionaire saying what he wants from the sitting city council members, and you have the mayor who's all out, all in for it, apparently what the citizens are saying, for the majority of them at least, is not going to count in this instance.
Well, lots of calls on this meanwhile, but we do need to move on. Lots of other stories to discuss here on the roundtable. A busy news week. It is 549-2937 to join the show. Here's another big talker. For the first time, a Duval County School Board member has formally requested that the local school board consider changing the controversial name of Nathan Bedford Forest High School. Board member Connie Hall submitting the request after the board heard impassioned pleas Tuesday night, both pro and con, on this issue. An online petition has garnered more than 100,000 signatures calling for a name change. Forrest, of course, was a Confederate general and leader in the Ku Klux Klan. Now, just the other day, we spoke on this program with Duval County School Superintendent Nicolai Vitti. He is in favor of a name change, and here's why.
When I speak nationally and people stop me, the first thing that they say is, don't you have a high school named after a former leader of the KKK? And I want Jacksonville to be known for what we're doing regarding children outcomes, graduation rates, reading proficiency, not the name of a school. And I think it is time for a change, but there's a right way to do it. And I think we're walking down that right road in how to do it, because it has to ultimately be owned by the community.
And we want to hear from you, the community, right now. Do you think it's time to change the name of Forrest High School? We'll go to the phones in just a moment on this one at 549-2937. Kyle Sieg, you're smiling a little bit. Of course, this isn't the first time at the rodeo for us on this issue. Most of us have covered this more than once. This has come up again and again.
Yes, and it probably still will. The overwhelming reaction from this week that I think we've talked about, at least in our newsroom, is the word fact. And what I find in this conversation that we repeatedly have is you have two sides of people both coming at this using facts, and I put air quotes around that, to make their point. And the problem is a lot of people don't understand the facts. It's such an emotional debate that we kind of tend to ignore things. We had two people on my show a few days ago, one obviously in support, one obviously against. And you know, the one against the name change says, hey, come look at actual manuscripts that you can see in my museum. Anyone can come on by. And he kind of downplays the level at which he was in the Ku Klux Klan, that sort of thing. And then the guy on the other side says, well, no, he was a murderer and all of this stuff. It all comes down to fact. And we're kind of overlooking that.
Well, let's talk about what we do know about this, about how the school was named. It was named amid pressure from a group, the Daughters of the Confederacy, in response to the federal push to desegregate the nation's public schools. So essentially, the name was a finger in the eye to that huge societal change. Those who say it's time to change the name point to that point of history is the overriding reason why.
It's the interesting bit when you talk about facts and emotion that to some extent the facts obviously matter, but people's feelings almost become one of those facts that come into play. So somebody looks back and says it was named for this reason. They're offended by, I mean, you know, maybe they named it after the wrong guy, but they did it for that reason. You know, they named it Bob Smith, trying to be a poke in the eye. It's like that would almost be as offensive because of the motivation. So it's a lot of emotion is tied up in it.
Here's David tweeting the show. So when are we going to rename the city of Jacksonville? Andrew Jackson did not have a sterling reputation either. Fred, what are your thoughts? Andrew, too.
This is the term comes to mind, vestiges. When we moved to desegregate the schools for the final time back in the 90s to get the system we have now, where you can go to any school you want to, you're free to go. We didn't have bus. We have busing no longer for the purpose of segregation. Now you can get on the bus and go to whatever school you want. This is the last vestige of that segregated society, and that's what we're arguing about. I mean, we're also in the South. I mean, let's face it, if you go downtown, we have Washington Street. You can find Washington, you can find Jefferson, you can find Adams Street, but you won't find Lincoln Street, okay? If you're in St. Augustine, that's why they have the Lincolnville Festival, because you don't have a Lincoln anywhere around St. Augustine except when they have the festival, because in the South, we weren't for him, okay? And that's what we're dealing with here. From the school board standpoint, we also have a new generation of school board members. When this was turned down 4 years ago, it was the last of the school board members on there, with the exception of probably Cheryl Grimes, who were linked to that, through the vestiges of what happened. These new school board members don't have the linkage. You also have a superintendent who's progressive and doesn't have a linkage to it and can see past that. So that's the change we have in the South, and that's what you see playing out here.
Andrew.
I mean, I grew up in Jacksonville. I went to school, I worked in other states, and then I came back to Jacksonville. I consider myself a Southerner, and I also don't understand why we live in a city named after a president who drove out natives and then bragged about it to the Congress, saying they should be thanking us.
The Trail of Tears.
Yeah, and he literally went to Congress and said they should be thanking us for what we've done. And I also don't understand why we have to name all of our schools after generals when they're very peaceful people who have done a lot of good. I mean, look at Mandarin High School. Why isn't that named after Harriet Beecher Stowe, who literally wrote the book about Mandarin? I mean, she wrote an entire book about the farming community of Mandarin in the 1800s. I mean, we're so set on we have to honor our Southern heroes, but there are more Southern heroes than just those who are accused of massacring Black Union soldiers. And I think we need to look at the Southern heroes who are universally respected and try to make those the people that we identify with. I mean, as a Southerner, I don't want people to identify, you know, Southern heroes as all being killers or all being generals. I want them to see that there are also Southern heroes who were inventors. There are Southern heroes who were farmers. There were Southern heroes who pushed forward agriculture drastically through technology. And that's what I want to see schools named after. I don't want to see schools, any more schools named after killers. I want to see more schools named after thinkers.
Let's go to the phones. Chelsea on the West Side is with us. Good morning, Chelsea. What are your thoughts? Chelsea? All right, give us a call back. Gil on the South Side, a friend of the show. Hi, Gil.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
Okay.
Okay, good. One of the things about the Nathan Bedford Forrest High School name, which I haven't heard very much, is the fact that in 1954, when they had the board, Brown versus Board of Education, that, of course, changed the segregated South and North. But there wasn't any time frame for that. So it took 2 years before, after Brown versus Board of Education was said to be done with all deliberate speed, the integration of the school. So a few years after that, when Nathan Bedford High School was, when they were thinking about a name for Nathan Bedford High School, they essentially put that in, because all deliberate speed doesn't mean anything. It's like when they say we shall overcome someday, there's no time certain on that.
Right. Well, yeah, and it's my understanding full integration didn't happen for years. Yeah.
Exactly. So the point is, they essentially, it sounded like they put the name of Nathan Bedford Forrest to say, we're not going to do it. We're going to go against the Supreme Court. And it was just kind of a stick in the eye for integration in the South. And it wasn't too long after that we had the Axe Handle Saturday and other kinds of things. So Nathan Bedford Forrest needs to be changed to something a little bit more progressive.
And Gil, thanks for the call. Thanks for the call. Just want to keep moving, get some more phones in here. Let's go to James on the North Side. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Come on, let me turn the radio down.
Okay. Go ahead, James.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
Listen, I live on a 34-foot sailboat on the north side, and if men had had their way, like the guy that school is named after, I wouldn't be here. And I cannot understand the mindset of people who would have their children attend a school named after a known racist and founder of the KKK. I just do not understand it. There's nothing to be proud about there. And if I had graduated from that school, I would be embarrassed and ashamed to tell people what school I came from, because some people will look it up and say, oh, this guy was such and such.
Yeah. Thanks, James, for your thoughts. Well, in the meantime, for those that have just been haven't been following this, the board is actually going to meet today on this again and discuss the next steps. Lots more community input needed before a decision is made.
They'll get that.
Oh, yes. Now, let's talk a little bit about juvenile justice. State Attorney Angela Corey this week defended charging juveniles as adults in certain cases, saying Wednesday that she draws a line on gun crimes when it comes to her office's decision to charge minors in the adult system. Corey has come under fire for the practice as the new Juvenile Justice Coalition in the city is pushing for more civil citations to be used for first-time juvenile offenders rather than incarceration. State Attorney Corey made her remarks during a debate sponsored by the James Madison Institute. Fred Matthews, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I think everyone would like to not see our state attorney in the news on anything that doesn't concern trying a case. What is continually disturbing about what State Attorney Corey is doing here is that, again, she's going against the very grain, the legal trends that have already been set and what's in place here. She stated her case to be tough on crime. Everybody understood that when she got elected. There couldn't be any doubt about it. But the science that surrounds prosecution of juveniles is there, and the trends in both within the prosecutorial community and the defense community have been set for some time. Prior state attorneys, going back to Ed Austin, who was one of our longest-serving state attorneys, started this process of making sure that juveniles had a chance in life as they go forth. We all understand how heinous the crimes can be. There's no doubt about that. But the issue is still the same. We afford our young people an opportunity, a chance. And for the state attorney to stand in the doorway and say, no, not here. I don't believe in the science. Their brains are the same as everybody else's brains. Flies in the face of what we all who have children know not to be the case.
Well, it's basically a philosophical difference at that point of, is the goal of criminal justice to reform somebody, or is the goal of criminal justice to punish somebody? And you say, hey, they did a heinous crime, treat them as an adult, lock them away for life. You're not trying to make them better at that point. You're trying to lock them away for life, I guess.
But that flies in the face of the trends of what we are doing in the state and around the country.
This circuit does have a higher percentage of juveniles going into the system than other circuits around the state. Here's a quote, though, from the state attorney. She's saying that the kids coming through the courtroom today are different than in years past. And I quote, some of these kids are bigger than any person in this room, and some of them are meaner than anyone you've ever come across.
To which someone said to Ms. Corey, their brains still aren't, you know, any more developed just because they're bigger. They're still children's brains. But then she responded that they're committing adult crimes and therefore they need to be punished as adults. I think it's potentially dangerous when children are being punished as adults for adult crimes and not being given a chance to learn from, I mean, their behavior from learning from the heinous crimes they've committed to be able to say, you know, this was as serious as it is, and giving them a chance to reform. Because if we start locking everyone up who, when they're, you know, in high school, gets incredibly emotional and commits heinous crimes, then we're going to have too many people going to prison without a chance of reforming them. And then what happens with our next generation of people? I mean, we're not going to have much of a generation. Already in Florida, 10% of people in Florida cannot vote because they have criminal records. I mean, that's a large percentage of people who don't have a say in the political process because of the crimes they've committed and the punishment they've experienced. If we're punishing them, studies show that they're more likely to commit more crimes.
Well, another perspective here, I mean, we're talking about things on the back end of this. I mean, are children just randomly being born meaner nowadays? Or is it that perhaps, you know, we need to focus on some stuff earlier in life to help children along in the process, whether it be better education or teaching parents how to be parents? You know, that's also something. It's not like our children are randomly just being born meaner. And Angela Corey did mention that, you know, she'd like to see an elementary school class taught, but that class was to teach about the consequences of doing something wrong. I mean, again, I think one of the biggest debates that we're having is rather than just punishing kids, teaching kids right from wrong, teaching kids correctly, and trying to figure out why kids are meaner, if they are indeed meaner, than we all were when we were younger. Why is that? Let's try to solve that. That's what a lot of people are saying as well.
Yeah. I sat in on a juvenile justice diversion program several months ago, and I wasn't arrested. I was just, you know, reporting on it. just make that clear. But it was fascinating.
You do have a rough look about you.
Yeah, I know. It was exactly what you just said, Kyle, of that idea of how do we train these kids things that they haven't learned earlier in life, you know. So if you haven't learned that the way to not deal with somebody who's, you know, messing with you, okay, you punch him in the face. Well, we learn not to do that. Now these kids have to learn that. But if they learn it by going to jail, it doesn't, you know, really help them in the same way that a diversionary program does.
We did a story earlier this week, and I think it was a nationwide story, but it was about kids like who are in high school, for example, and commit a crime, whether it's they randomly pull a prank, you know, and the overcharging, the criminal charging of things that in times past were not actually criminal charges. It was, oh, you know, it's kids being kids, just having a good time.
That's where I think it's not necessarily kids being meaner. It's things being taken more seriously. Now, sometimes that's good. The entire bullying thing, you know, when we were kids, I don't think bullying was taken as seriously as it is now. Right. That's probably a good thing.
And let's go to Jim at the beaches. He's on the line. Hi, Jim. How are you today?
Hey, good morning. How are y'all?
Great.
My comment is that one thing I do notice is Miss Corey has no kids, and I think if she had kids, I think she would have a little bit different approach toward children.
Well, let me ask you, though, Jim, would you say that if the state attorney was a man?
Well, look at the last two state attorneys, Harry Shorstein and Ed Austin. They both had children. Their attitudes are a little bit different.
And one thing that's missing, too, from this
picture. Thanks,
Jim. One thing that's missing from this picture is that we have a weak defense system. Many of the kids who go through this juvenile system are going to be dependent upon the public defender. That's missing from this equation. And without a strong public defense system, you have this kind of pleading going on, and acceptance of pleas without competent counsel. Granted, a number of these kids do have private counsel, but missing from this argument is that defense system, which could help in waylaying and getting a lot of these alternate sentences to make them happen. And we don't have that here in Duval County in particular. We have a very weak public defense system.
Go ahead, Andrew.
Oh, and I was going to say, I mean, we don't have a lot of oversight over juvenile justice programs. There was a study released this year that said in Florida, 10% of youth who will enter a juvenile delinquent facility will be sexually assaulted, and most of those will be by a staff member. And that's, I mean, for any crime in a juvenile delinquency facility. I know we're specifically dealing with charging children as adults for gun crimes, but I think that should be weighed into a conversation about overcharging children and how we deal with that. I mean, whether we send them to a delinquent facility, whether we try to rehabilitate them, try to teach them the sort of life lessons that Tim was mentioning, how to deal with anger, how to deal with conflict. But when the response is only ship them away and they'll learn their lesson that way, I mean, they're going to be damaged even more there, and then they're going to come out even angrier, and they're going to come out even bigger, because if they're 6'2 at 14, as Ms. Corey is pointing out, then they're going to be even bigger when they're 18 and they've been molested or they've been attacked in a delinquent facility.